guy used to play Superman. And he shot himself. What?
Someone thinks he didn't.
Mr. Reeves, why don't you tell me about him?
A charming man.
I'm much too old for you, you know?
Your husband is the general manager of MGM.
Tell me what you want. You can have it.
Where he wound up, it should have been enough.
What are these? These marks. What did he do, beat himself up before he shot himself?
Dead detective. What you got?
Some questions.
Since when do suicides miss twice and start over? That's unusual.
You ever been to a party where a man goes upstairs and blows his head off?
No.
Then how do you know what's unusual?
There's more going on than you realize.
George shot himself. He was shot.
Who did that?
You have anything to tell me?
Anything I need to have a story ready for.
This murder, I think it might be true.
What's true or false really doesn't matter. If it hurts the studio, if it stops one person from buying tickets, I have to fix it.
This is how they work, and it just gets buried.
Had a bullet put in Reeves' head.
Why?
I'll always take care of my boy.
You could have gotten me something, but you didn't. Because you liked me where I was in a red suit. But that's not who I am.
Who's gonna wipe the blood off your hands?
My hands? Prove it. I'm in the picture business.
Based on the true story of Hollywood's most notorious unsolved mystery.
I see the pieces, how they should fit, how I want them to fit.
Hollywoodland.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Network of Podcasts. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me again is our pal, Chris Franklin. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back, Rob. It seems like I just left.
It does. Yeah. Now, I will say this episode, we're going to talk about the 2006 biography, crime, drama, thriller, Hollywoodland, which is all about the life and suspicious death of George Reeves. This was Chris's idea. Chris had mentioned this because I had talked about that we had wanted to do a couple of Batman v Superman related episodes on the network. And of course, we did the Power Records podcast. And I didn't really have any ideas for how to tie into the movie on this show, and then Chris suggested Hollywoodland, and I'd never seen this movie, actually, which was surprising to me, considering it seems to have everything I like. It's set in the old-timey, you know, like the 40s and 50s. It's Hollywood. It's got comic books involved. You would think I would have jumped at this, but somehow I just missed it. So this was great, actually, the opportunity to watch it for the first time. As I mentioned, it is, you know, nominally about the life and death of George Reeves as he was playing Superman in The Adventures of Superman. He is played here by... Who, Chris?
Ben Affleck.
Yeah, Batman himself plays Superman, though he's used to being in tights. It also features Adrian Brody as a detective hired to investigate the Reeves murder, Bob Hoskins as Hollywood fixer Eddie Mannix, more about that in a moment, and playing Tony Mannix, which is Eddie's wife, who is sleeping with George Reeves on the side, is Diane Lane, who, of course, is in Man of Steel as who?
Martha Kent.
There you go. So this is a very strange confluence of actors here. So Chris, you saw this movie, I guess, when it came out. Is that true?
I saw it when it came out, first came out on DVD.
Okay.
I didn't see it in the theater. I had kind of followed the story that they were going to make a movie about George Reeves. I had always been fascinated by George Reeves' death. I don't know at what point I learned that George Reeves had supposedly committed suicide. I was young because, you know, I grew up watching The Adventures of Superman.
Sure.
It was in heavy syndication.
Yep.
When we were kids.
Yep.
As we've mentioned before. And at some point I did learn that George Reeves died, and it was deemed a suicide. And, you know, and I think at the time it was just, you know, it was a suicide, period. And, you know, which was hard to swallow, you know, as a little kid. You know, you don't really quite understand that, but you just know it's bad, obviously.
Right. Yep.
But, you know, even as a kid, I encountered the crazy rumors that surrounded his death. Like, you know, the persistent rumor that he was so lost in his role of Superman, or so, you know, out of touch with reality that he jumped out of a skyscraper window.
I heard that one too, yeah.
I mean, I got in an argument with a mother of one of my friends over that. And I mean, to the point where I think she was ready to kick me out, because she was a kid of the era and, you know, he jumped out a window. No, he didn't. He shot himself. You know, so, I mean, you know, so I guess that's one reason why I've always kind of been fascinated by it. So I kind of followed. They were going. This was kind of coming along, at the same time that Superman Returns was in production, and they came out the same year.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, you know, I'd heard that Hugh Jackman was supposed to play George Reeves, which I'm like,
that makes my brain hurt to think about
it. It does. Which, and then they cast Ben Affleck, and this was before this was back when Ben Affleck had really made some really crappy movies.
he was in movie jail. There's no doubt about that.
He was in movie jail, and we hadn't really seen him do anything of any substance in quite some time. And so I was not very happy to hear that. But, you know, then I started seeing pictures of him, and I'm like, well, you know, he kind of resembles George Reeves more than probably Hugh Jackman would. Not that, you know, I mean, obviously you want the better actor in the part. But one thing that really jumped out at me was when they started showing trailers for this, it kind of killed it for me to a point, because they would show him in the Superman suit in the commercials and the trailers without the S. And I'm thinking, okay, are they not going to be able to do this because this isn't being made by Warner Brothers? And it turns out Warner Brothers was really kind of putting the screws to the people making this movie. They killed the original title, which was Truth, Justice, and the American Way.
Right.
They wouldn't let them use the Superman S. They made them redo the opening credits of The Adventures of Superman when you see it in the movie. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. But I think they... And oddly enough, in a movie about the studio system and what it does to people, this big Hollywood studio kind of kept this movie down. And, you know, they had a big Superman movie coming out that year. They didn't want this small movie about the death and the suicide or murder of an actor who had played Superman stealing away their thunder. So I think that had a lot to do with it. And so I waited. I saw it when it first came out on DVD. I didn't see in the theater. It was kind of it seems like this movie really is kind of under the radar. It's like people are kind of aware of it, but I think a lot of people are like you. They just never got around to seeing it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I watched it and I liked it. And I hadn't watched it. I thought it was pretty interesting how they handled the various theories that I had read about over the years, and then the casting was very interesting in the parallel stories that run in the movie. So I dug it out a while back and watched it again, and then I watched it again for this purpose. So what did you think of it?
I came to it. I mean, it opens, as Chris mentioned, it sort of does a parallel track, because it opens with George Reeves dead. And so all the stuff with George Reeves is done in – I mean, of course, the whole movie's a flashback because it's set in the 50s. But it's with a flashback within a flashback, because we have the character of Adrian Brody, the detective who was hired to investigate the murder, who was completely made up. This is a made-up character for the movie, Louis Simo. And he is sort of a detective on the sort of fringes. There's a whole thing about where he's investigating a woman who's been hired by her husband to see if she's sleeping around, and she is. And the husband gets so mad that he murders her. And so he feels a little guilty that he sort of pieced that together. And he's got a wife and a son that he's divorced from. The wife kind of doesn't think much of him. So there's that whole storyline, which, as fine as Adrian Brody was in the movie, I didn't think it was necessary. I actually kind of would have preferred if the whole movie had just been about George Reeves.
Right.
And I had heard, like you, that you know, the original name of the movie was going to be Truth, Justice, and the American Way, which to me is a much better title.
Mm-hmm.
And then Warner Brothers, you know, said no. And I, you know, for a couple of years I thought, a bunch of spoil sports. But now that I've seen the movie, I get it. It is very grim. I could see why they wouldn't want the connection. And also, considering how much this movie is about Adrian Brody, that title really isn't appropriate. This movie is really more about Adrian Brody than it is George Reeves. Mm-hmm. So that title, as much as it, to me, it's more interesting than Hollywoodland. Hollywoodland is just kind of bland and generic. It doesn't really mean much of anything. Truth, Justice doesn't really fit. There is one scene of Ben Affleck literally being Superman, like they do a recreation of the show, and I love that sequence. I would have loved to have seen more of that. It was really interesting to see it again because, yeah, like you, I grew up on the show. It's funny you mentioned that they had to re-record the opening crawl, and I never, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but like those words, faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful, that is so much in my brain, like a song lyric, that when they do that version in the movie and it's changed a little, my brain immediately went, that's not right. They skipped the part. That's not, you know, I heard the whole thing in my head because I just listened to that theme so many times. And I think Ben Affleck is terrific as George Reeves. He really, I think he strikes that melancholy of somebody who kind of can't believe that his career is sort of over. And he is very unhappy that he is, as he puts it, sort of stuck playing this dumb part. And yet he imbues it with George Reeves with a certain amount of dignity. There's a great scene where he, after he is Superman, he's in a restaurant with his agent. And I forget who the other person is. And there's Tony Mannix. You're right. Yeah. And there's a bunch of kids outside and they see him and they're all like, Superman. And he gets up and he walks over and he straightens himself up and he puts his arms on his hips like Superman. And he's there to entertain the kids. And like, that's really sweet. Like, and from what I knew of George Reeves, that was true. That he took that seriously, that he was like, I don't want kids to have a bad image of Superman. So when he did public appearances, he kept himself to a certain moral standard, which I thought was really very touching. And so the stuff, like I said, the stuff with Adrian Brody didn't interest me as much, but every time they had the stuff with Affleck as Reeves, I thought it was great. I really thought it was very interesting, and it was neat to see, you know, the Superman costume in black and white, like as it looked in real life. Mm-hmm. You know, because it was all browns and grays and stuff. And, you know, there's even a scene where Tony Mannix is like, you don't even get to wear red and blue. And they're like, no, red and blue doesn't contrast well on a black and white screen and that whole bit. So yeah. I actually like the movie quite a bit. I don't know if the approach they took was the one that I would have taken. But no, I liked it quite a bit and I thought it was quite interesting. And like you, I was always fascinated with how did George Reeves die? Because, again, supposedly he killed himself, but there was a bullet hole in the wall. In the ceiling. Well, what did the guy do? What did he miss? I mean, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So it's one of those things that'll never be solved because, as they posit in the movie, that there was basically a cover up that Eddie Mannix, this fixer, had him killed because he was, he hurt. Apparently, Eddie Mannix was perfectly fine with his wife fooling around.
Right.
It was only after George Reeves basically kicked her to the curb for a younger woman that Eddie got so mad that he had supposedly had Reeves killed. And there was a whole thing about Reeves's brake line was messed up with, and he had a car accident. So all that is true. So it's tragic. You know, you're like this the poor guy. And he was so iconic as Superman that he led this sad life.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, that I'm kind of with you on the Adrian Brody part, but at this time when I was watching it, and this is probably like the third time I've seen it, I understood it the first time, but it kind of hit home more that idea of the parallel story. Because both the Louis Simo character and George Reeves, they're both reaching for something that they're just not going to get. I mean, you know, the Simo character, he had worked for one of the big agencies in town, detective agencies, that was tied to MGM. And tied to the studios, and he had basically been kicked out. He took the fall for another detective that he worked with, and so he was reaching beyond his grasp. And George Reeves, if you look at George Reeves' filmography and read any history, he had several brushes with legitimate Hollywood stardom. I mean, he was in Gone with the Wind,
right. Which he never fails to mention. In this movie, he mentioned that at the top of a hat. I was in Gone with the Wind, and there were people like, "You were? What role were you in Gone with the Wind?"
Well, the Tarleton twins, or whatever. Yeah, and then, you know, he was in So Proudly We Hail, and he was in movies like that. And apparently, he was almost at the cusp of reaching that stardom, and then he was sent. You know, then he was drafted for World War II, and even though he didn't, I don't think ever served in combat, he was actually in a in one of the actors' troops that did movies and plays and things, and that just kind of, you know, they don't really go into that so much in the movie, but you know, that, and that's kind of interesting. It's interesting in this movie what they do and don't tell you. There's nothing really that's in the movie that I know of that's with Reeves that they fabricate completely. I mean, they maneuver things as they need to for the story. But there's some interesting angles in his life that they either omit, probably out of time. But some of it, I think in a way they paint him. The legend says that he was pretty down on his luck toward the end of his life, and that he Superman was over and he couldn't get work anywhere. But the truth is that Superman was actually going to go back into production.
Right, they were going to do two more seasons of it.
Right, and he was going to direct. He had directed some episodes in the last season, the last several episodes of the last season, and he had even been on the set like a few weeks prior to his death, and he had a production company, which they talk about in the movie, but he had several projects in the works, and apparently the day he died, he actually had a call on his answering service that he had got a part in another movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh man.
So I mean, they paint him as really just and you even get the idea that they're pretty blunt about the fact that Mannix is actually out to destroy his career at this point, and barring him from getting any work, which I don't think that's kind of a place where maybe the movie, is whether Mannix was involved in his death, he was at least putting the screws to him, his career, And an interesting thing about Mannix that I didn't know, I was reading on IMDb, I have not seen the film Hail Caesar.
Right, he's the main character in Hail Caesar.
It played by Josh Brolin.
Right.
Who was, until recently, the real-life husband of Diane Lane.
That's right.
There's all
very,
sorts
very
of
strange, yeah.
Very strange stuff going on in this film.
Her former, her other husband is in Hail Caesar, because she used to be married to Christopher Lambert, the Highlander.
Yeah, is he in that?
And he's in Hail Caesar. He has one scene in Hail Caesar as well.
Oh, wow.
Very strange. I wonder if him and Brolin had any. So, any conversations they had.
Trade notes about Diane Lane.
Exactly.
I thought she was really good in this. I mean, she, the way they portray Tony Mannix is, I mean, she's instantly, of course, Diane Lane's very, very pretty, very attractive. But the way they portray her, she's actually playing older than she is to begin with.
Right.
And then, as this movie was filmed, and then, she's got a younger man in George. And, that kind of, she appears younger because she's, she's in this relationship with this younger man. And her and Eddie have this very open relationship. There's even a very awkward scene where they're all – Eddie's with his Japanese girlfriend that doesn't speak English. And George and Tony, they're all at dinner together.
Yeah.
which is very, very awkward. And you could even – you feel the awkwardness for George. But he feels awkward in that situation. But the way that as time goes on and Reeves, they portray George Reeves as a kept man.
Right. She bought him a house. She bought him a car because she had all of Eddie Mannix's money. So
right.
she lavished him with all these gifts.
And I think they may have played that up a little bit more too, because I do know that George Reeves was apparently pretty successful at renegotiating his Superman contracts every time that they take a break between episodes, because they are on a weird schedule for that show. They'd film a bunch of them at once and then be off for like a year and a half,
mm-hmm.
and then get back together and film more, which is that's obviously not. I mean, well, actually, some TV shows are going more back to that now,
mm-hmm,
but that's how they did it back then. But it's interesting. I have a book, Superman from Serial to Serial. It's mostly about the Adventures of Superman TV show. It's from the 70s by author Gary Grossman, and it talks about Reeves' death. But it's funny how I don't know if it was. If maybe the author didn't know about all the various conspiracies at that point, but he doesn't mention anything about Mannix or Leonor Lemon, who is Reeves' fiance that he meets while he's in New York and begins an affair with her, and then he leaves Tony for her. It doesn't mention any of that, but there is a picture of Tony Mannix with George Reeves on the set of Superman.
Huh.
And I thought that was that's about the only picture I've ever seen of her. And she is she's an older woman compared to Reeves. And Reeves was getting close to 40 by this point. But it's interesting how at the toward the end of the movie, it's almost like, you know, once Reeves leaves her, Diane Lane, you don't even hardly see her in the light until there's this dramatic reveal, and she is looks like she has aged about 20 years since the last time they showed her.
Yeah, a very picture of Dorian Gray kind of moment there, because you see her, you're like, whoa, what's happened here? Yeah, it's funny you mentioned this about that they didn't really make anything up. Now there is a scene where he is doing George Reeves is doing an appearance as Superman in front of kids, and it's like almost like a stunt show. Mm-hmm. And he runs and he's like punching cowboys, and he's grabbing their fake guns and bending them, and the kids are going eh. And this little kid comes up to Superman with a loaded gun,
mm-hmm.
and George Reeves can see that there's bullets in the chamber, and George Reeves is like, "Where did you get that, little boy?" And he says, "Oh, from my dad's drawer." It's like, you know, don't even get me started on that. And and the music gets really serious, because then it's a really tense scene, because the kid wants to shoot Superman to watch the bullets bounce. And George Reeves has to talk the kid down, and he says, "Well, you know, of course the bullets will bounce off me, but they might strike someone else. You don't want that to happen, do you?" And the kid's like, "No, I guess not." And he diffuses the situation. And I read about that, and supposedly that never happened. But now, that according to legend, that never happened. But George Reeves said it happened.
Right.
So we'll never know. People seem to suggest that he said that to get out of wearing the costume in public anymore, because apparently other kids would throw rocks at him and stuff because they wanted to watch it bounce off of Superman. And so, yeah, he really feel bad for the poor guy.
Right.
He's just trying to entertain some children, and he's getting pelted with stones and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But that scene is genuinely terrifying.
It is.
Because it's like, boy, it's a really sweet – I mean, you know how unhappy he is being Superman, but he's giving it his all. You know, he's out there, and he's flexing his muscles, and he's punching the cowboy, the bad guys, and he's really – and then it turns on a dime, so – it just gets so dark, and mm-hmm. you really do feel that sense of like, oh, my – oh, Lord, this could go bad so quickly. And so, you know, we'll never know whether that's true or not, but that's the only scene I heard of that is like – objectively made up, but again, nobody knows. Maybe that did happen to George Reeves.
It's a long lasting legend, though. It's even in that book from the 70s. So, if they had left it out, that's too great of a legend to leave out. It's too great of a story to leave out, whether it's true or not. And and I was expecting that scene in the movie. I'm like, oh, they got to put the scene in with the kid. with the kid with the gun. And, you know, and it's, you know, at the end they make this big deal about how you know, where he can't get any work, his manager keeps mentioning this wrestling gig. And you know, the whole deal at the end is that he's gonna have to try to get in shape for this wrestling gig, and the Louis Simo character at the very end of the film actually gets a hold of the test reel of his wrestling workout that the manager had, and it shows a very, you know, despondent and probably too old George Reeves, you know, just he's aching. He can't do the judo moves without, you know, throwing out his back. And it shows him, you know, doing the cut thing on his neck, you know, cut the film and quit rolling. But now the truth of the matter is that just a few years prior, Reeves had went out with Noelle Neal, who, of course, played Lois Lane on the series. And his friend, who's actually in the movie, I'll pronounce his name wrong, Natavidad Basio, Latino friend that's in the movie, and they went out on a tour, and George would wrestle, in his Superman costume, would rescue Lois from this guy named Mr. Kryptonite in this black suit. And I've seen pictures of it. I think I may have actually seen it at the Metropolis, Illinois Superman Museum, but there's a picture of it in Michael Urie's Krypton Companion from Tomorrows. But he would wrestle this guy, and, you know, he'd defeat the guy, and then he'd come back out as Clark Kent, and him and his buddy, Natavidad, would play, sing Spanish songs. Well, you see George, you know, playing guitar and singing through the movie. He was a accomplished guitarist and singer, and they did this whole roadshow thing that they would make these appearances. So the movie paints that as this awful thing that he's got to go do, but in reality, it was kind of like just, well, he already went and did it before, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, he might not have wanted to do that. I'm not saying that was – he'd much rather have been in a, you know, Class A quality motion picture. But, you know, they take those little elements, and it's interesting how they kind of you know, ooh, this is really kind of, you know. I mean, is that really any worse than, you know, a guy sitting at a table waiting for people to come up and sign autographs? a lot of celebrities do now, you know. Yeah. Obviously, we go and wait in line for them. So, you know, I do think it's interesting to think, and I'm with you. I could honestly, we could have not followed that parallel story with Simo, but I do get the point that, you know, Simo's not even an actor or a writer or a producer, and even he's getting ground up. Mm-hmm. In the Hollywood machine of the time. You know, he even talks about how he's with his girlfriend at one part of the movie, and there's this awful scar on his side, and he tells her the story how he got it. His father was a security guard at Warner Brothers, and there was a strike, and he came back from service in World War II. He never got injured there, but, you know, he goes out on the lot and is a security guard, and he gets stabbed, you know,
yeah.
in the side. And so, you know, it's just like, wow, it's just another thing to point how ruthless this business is. And Eddie Mannix is one scary guy in this
movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, wow. There's one scene where he's dealing with this actor who has, you know, been caught in a compromising position with another man, which, you know, of course, back then was a big no-no, and they're going to have to cover it up. And you get the feeling that, you know, that they're not going to take too much of that, more of that from the actor. He's
yep.
looks like he's scared to death, and
yep.
and it's just it's really interesting. I also thought it's funny. I was sitting there watching. I was like, Bob Hoskins with that accent. He's in Hollywood. His name's Eddie. Eddie Valiant went bad after Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, that's sad. I don't want to think about that. That's a sad thing. Yeah, it's, you know, as anyone who listens to either Firewater or this show knows, that I have a very romantic view of Hollywood in like the 40s and 30s and 40s and 50s, but I have to realize it was a really brutal business. I mean, it's probably less brutal now. I think nowadays it's the brutality comes from just the money aspect, but back right. then they really owned people, yeah. lock, stock, and barrel in many ways, and a lot of people really did get chewed up and spit out. And like you point out, you know, Louis Primo is not even in the business, and he's adversely affected. I mean, he's just investigating this with this fishy story, and at one point he gets hit in the face with a chain,
right.
which was like, oh my awful. God! And then there's a great button on that where later on, like, he's got that big wound on his face and he answers the phone and he puts the receiver up to the part with the bruise, because that's just the habit, and he goes like, ah, you know, he forgets that his whole half of his face is smashed in. And so it was, you know, I would love to have lived in Hollywood in the 40s, but it probably would have killed me, because I'm just too soft. I wouldn't be able to stand all these tough guys in there. It's funny they mention Hail Caesar, because in that movie, Eddie Mannix is much more genteel. He seems much more – I mean, he's rough around the edges, but he seems more avuncular. And here by Bob Costas, he seems like a mobster. Like, he'll just kill you and he'll dump you in the river and stuff like that if you get involved with movie business. And related to George Reeves, you know, the thing I couldn't help but think when watching this is, you know, and I've mentioned this about Dick Dillon, that Dick Dillon died, you know, early. George Reeves just didn't live long enough to see how beloved he would become.
Right.
You know, like Adam West went through a similar dark night of the, no pun intended, dark yeah. night of the soul, where, you know, in the 70s, he couldn't get arrested. You know, he was reduced to doing Batman appearances at car shows, you know, which is so sad. But he lived long enough. He's still with us, of course, thank goodness, that the generation that grew up on Batman got into Hollywood and became powerful and loved him. And now he's treated like an elder statesman. He's revered as the sort of legend that he is because he's Batman.
Right.
You know, he's the original 60s Batman. And so now he probably lives quite a nice life of being treated really well. And George Reeves never got that. If George Reeves had lived another 20 years, he would have been old enough to have the first generation that grew up on Superman love him. They would have been like, you're Superman.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Kirk Allen lived long enough to get to do that cameo in the 1978 Superman movie.
Right.
You know, because it was like a paying tribute to one of the original Superman. Now, if George Reeves had lived, that would have been George Reeves on the on the train with Noel Neal.
Yes.
You know, that's the saddest part about this. It's like, and who knows whether how much George Reeves that would have mattered to him. Maybe wouldn't have mattered, but I like to think that it might have, you know, that if he had lived long enough and he would have seen, oh my God, I mean so much to these kids that grew up on Superman. It might have given him a feeling of, you know what, it wasn't wasted. The 6 years I played Superman, it was not wasted time.
Right. You know, there's different quotes from people that, you know, and it's according to who they're talking to, people that actually appeared on The Adventures of Superman, including, you know, his co-stars like Jack Larson that of course played Jimmy and Phyllis Coates that was originally Lois and Noel Neal. But, you know, even guest actors like Milton Frome and Herb Vigran, our favorite Herb Vigran that was in White Christmas.
that's right, yeah.
But, you know, there's quotes from them in different articles and books I've read. And you know, there's a few times I think Milton Frome said, you know, George said something about, or he said something, Frome said, you know, man, you've got, the kids love you, you know, you've got a great thing here, and you're, you know, the idol of all these kids. And by all accounts, although occasionally people said he got a little frustrated because of the adulation from the kids, George Reeves was a really big advocate for children's charities and good with kids and everything. But, you know, when Frome said that, he said, yeah, but, you know, is there even one, do I have one adult fan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Frome's like, well, all these parents sit at home and watch this show with their kids, you know? And I think if he had lived, I think you're right, I think he would have eventually, as those kids became adults, then he would have realized, hey, you know, like you said, they might have been kids then, but they're adults now, and they can, you know, they could give him parts, and they could mm-hmm. pat him on the back. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's I've heard the same thing about Bela Lugosi, who, of course,
right, it's really another great example, right?
Down on his luck toward the end of his life, to the point where he was, you know, making movies with Ed Wood, you know. So I mean, you know, which, you know, we got that great movie out of it, but you know, if Bela Lugosi had lived just a couple more years, the monster kid craze kicked in like almost like just right after he died.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, they started showing the movies on TV, they started making bottle kits and
Monsters of Filmland,
Famous Monsters magazine and all, you know, and all this stuff. And if, you know, like you said, if Reeves had lived, you know, I mean, like, you know, like you were talking about Adam West, I mean, Adam West was on the Big Bang Theory a few weeks ago taking pot shots at the other actors who played Batman. So, I mean, that could have been George Reeves, you know. Mm-hmm. He could have been taking pot shots at Christopher Reeve and Dean Cain or whoever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it is sad, you know, maybe this isn't the place to do it, but the movie presents, you know, it basically presents three scenarios. One, that Mannix had a hit out on Reeve and he was killed by somebody in his employ. One, that Leonore Lemon, his very fairly one-dimensional
they don't present her in a great light in this movie. They basically present her as a floozy,
a gold digger. I mean, yeah. and a gold digger that found out that her man didn't have a whole lot of money of his own, which I'm not sure that's entirely true, but that's how they portray her in the movie.
Yeah.
And you know, it's degrees of that. Okay, is she just a gold digger? Is she a gold digger who's, you know, crazy enough to kill somebody, you know, or was mad enough at the moment to kill somebody. So you got, you know, that's another theory with her. And then, of course, there's the official ruling that he did it himself. And it's according to which day of the week you ask me about it, what I really think. There is that car accident. Whitney Ellsworth, who was an editor at DC and producer of Adventures of Superman, he had stated that he wondered if the car accident and either the accident itself or the combination of prescription pills and booze, because apparently George Reeves did like to drink, may have combined to put him out of his mind enough to do it. So there's that theory too. So there's really like three or four theories there, however you want to say. I don't know. It's like I said, it depends on what day of the week it is, what I believe, but there's enough there to just make you wonder. You know, it's just a very, very strange story. Much like the character of Louis Simo, George got in, by any all accounts, he seemed to kind of get in over his head in a few things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wouldn't surprise me if there wasn't something. And I don't think we'll ever know, you know, foul play or not. I mean, you know, I've always heard it's kind of funny they have the extra bullet holes in the floor in this movie, but I'd always heard they were in the wall. But I don't know, you know, that you read different things and who knows. But
yeah, I think if I have to pick a theory, which of course I don't, but if I do, I tend to think that he probably did it himself and the other bullet holes don't make sense. But you know what? Real life doesn't have to make sense. You know,
right.
Real life doesn't have to worry about that. And it just, I don't know. I mean, would you have him murdered for that? It seems a little extreme. I mean, again, it's happened, but I just tend to think, you know, maybe he got drunk, played around with a gun, and it got out of hand or whatever. I tend to think that the simplest answer is probably the one. So, and yeah, the movie does present all those scenarios. So, you know, we're kind of winding back to the movie a little as we wrap up here. I think it's a good movie. I did enjoy it. It's not exactly the movie I would have made, but nobody asked me, of course. But I think it's an interesting story, and it gives you, as I said, Affleck is terrific. It's neat seeing him in those period outfits. And I think if you're interested in Superman, which of course you are because you're listening to this, it gives you a nice little insight that you really wouldn't get to see normally because that story's sort of been lost to the ages. So I'm glad you suggested this, Chris. I thought it was a really good, pretty good movie.
Oh, good, good. I mean, you know, I think it deserves. I think anybody that's got any interest in the history of Superman, in particular the George Reeves TV series. I think the movie is pretty fair. It paints George in a very Reeves in a very human light.
But yes,
he's still a likable person. It doesn't paint him as just this awful person or anything like that. I think it's pretty fair.
Yeah,
and I think you know Affleck. He's got some of his mannerisms down. He's got the way he speaks down pretty well. They give him a prosthetic nose to kind of make him look a little more like Reeves,
mm-hmm.
Which in most shots looks really good. There's a couple of shots where it jumps out at you, like that might be the lighting or something. But
right. But
when he, I thought particularly when he was Clark Kent in the Daily Planet office, he looked a hell of a lot like George Reeves.
He sure did. He sure did.
Like, wow, you know. So and you know, of course, it's and the reason I suggested covering it here, it just seems really odd to think that. You know, this guy kind of sort of played Superman in a way, and now he's, of course, played Daredevil too. But now he's playing Batman, and you know, Diane Lane is Superman's mom, which is really strange.
Yeah, connections all over here. It's an interesting movie. It really is.
Yeah, I think it's worth a viewing. You know, I've heard some people say it drags a little, and I think some people are kind of like you. They go into it wanting to see more of the Reeves story, and instead, you know, and you know, you're presented with the Adrian Brody story. And I don't know if that was because he was the flavor, you know. I mean, obviously he's done other things, but he was really hot at the time. He came off an Oscar win and everything. So you know, that's probably one reason. If it was made today, well, maybe they'd pick another actor that had just won an Oscar, and cast him in that role. But yeah, I'd like to have seen a little more on him on Reeves, but. I think it's an interesting angle to take, and I think it's worth your time if you're a fan of old Hollywood or, of course, Superman.
There you go. Perfect. So, yeah, that's going to do it for Hollywoodland. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Chris, where can people find you on the internet?
Right here on the Fire & Water Podcast Network, on the Supermates Podcast, and the Power Records Podcast.
All right. Very cool. Yes. As I mentioned, next week we're going to be getting to Batman v Superman. Now, we are going to be doing that as an episode of the Fire & Water Podcast, not the Film & Water Podcast. That's that this movie covers every conceivable show on the network in terms of who could cover it. So it's going to end up being on Fire and Water, not Film and Water. We're going to cover something else. But it was nice to get something BVS related just before we get to that movie. So again, Chris, thanks for pointing it out. As always, you can contact us via the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can just go to the contact page and send a comment that way or leave a comment on the show page itself. The Twitter feed is at Film and Water Pod, and always use the hashtag FW Podcast. So, everybody, thanks for listening. Chris, thank you once again for joining me. I really appreciate it. It's always great having you on.
Oh, it's great to be here. Anytime.
Awesome. Again, thanks again, everybody, for listening. We're going to take some commercial messages, and then we're going to come back with some listener feedback.
Well, now that that's settled, suppose you two go out and start writing the story for the next edition.
Including my dream?
Definitely not.
Let's face it, Jimmy. Like I said, none of us will ever be able to do the things Superman does.
Well, I guess not. But golly, Mr. Kent, you'll never know how wonderful it is to be like Superman.
No, Jimmy, I guess I never will.
So which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man.
I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Doc who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Hello, listeners. I am Dr. G, the man of nerdology. I am the host of The Secret Sagas of the Multiverse, part of the Pulp to Pixel podcasts. Secret Sagas of the Multiverse is a review and discussion show where I and my rogues gallery of co-hosts take on topics related to comic books, superheroes, genre fiction, movies, television, and much more. We look at comics and comic characters across the many different media out there, from original print source material to the recent renaissance of television, movies, and digital media. If you love geek culture as much as we do, then tune in to our semi-weekly podcast series. Episodes of this and other Pulp to Pixel podcasts can be found at pulptopixel.blogspot.com, the Pulp to Pixel podcast Facebook page, through iTunes or through Stitcher under the Pulp to Pixel Podcasts.
Man, you come right out of a comic book.
The Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, exploring the media multiverse of geek culture.
He meddled in things and should leave the local.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get...
Welcome back, and now we're going to do our listener feedback segment. First, I want to get to the iTunes reviews. We have iTunes reviews now that the Film and Water podcast has its own feed. I thank you all very much for these iTunes reviews. We got 5 stars, Fun for Film Buffs by DS and RS. That is, of course, our pals, the Sutherlands. Rob Kelly's Fun podcast covers a wide variety of films and features a variety of guests. The conversations are always interesting. Highly recommended. 5 stars from Flash Fan Number 1, Smart and Funny Reviews. A great look at films by a true film lover and a rotating lineup of special guests. A must listen, especially to that Man Who Fell to Earth episode. 5 stars from Jose Rivera. Thank you, Jose. Quality film discussions. The Film and Water podcast sees Rob Kelly and a guest host tackle a movie each week. The beauty of this podcast is if you've seen the movies you're talking about, they're talking about, you can enjoy their rousing discussions and even learn a thing or two you might not have known. If you haven't seen the movies, you can still listen, and you might want to track it down and discover it for yourself. At the end of the day, it's Rob and a guest just shooting the breeze about movies. It's fun, it's entertaining, and you feel like you're sitting in a bar with friends talking about your favorite movies. Highly recommended. And finally, 5 stars from somebody named the Irredeemable Shag. And he says, if you love movies, come on, who doesn't? You'll love this podcast. Rob Kelly and an ever-changing roster of guests, hosts dive in and cover a diverse collection of movies and genres. From sci-fi, suspense, drama, comedy, superhero, feel-good, you name it. The hosts bring an impressive amount of knowledge about the actors and production and always manage to keep the discussion lively and engaging. When they cover a movie I've already seen, by the end of the podcast, I can't wait to watch it again. When they cover a movie I've never seen, I feel compelled to run out and watch the movie right away, which I've done several times after listening to the show. And the Oscar goes to the Film and Water podcast. Subscribe today. Thank you all for those reviews. I really do appreciate it. As anyone knows about podcasts, to help get the show noticed in the 40 bajillion podcasts that are out there on iTunes, we need reviews. So please go to the Film and Water podcast and on iTunes and leave the show a review. That will really, really help. So thank you all very much. In terms of the feedback we got, I keep saying we. I don't know why. I guess maybe because I'm thinking about it, the network, because now that we're all part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. But anyway, the show got a lot of feedback, and I really, really appreciate that. I want to catch up on episode 29, which was the Oscar show. These were two messages that came in just a little late after I'd already recorded the feedback segment, but I wanted to make sure I get them in. One was from Nathaniel Wayne, who, of course, was a guest on this very show for the Invasion of the Body Snatchers episode. He says, my interest in the Oscars has been on a steady decline since 2003, which was the last time I actually cared on an emotional level who won, because it was the year of Return of the King. At this point, the only reason I watch at all is that some friends of mine host an Oscar party for everyone who participates in their annual Oscar pool. The food is always themed to match each movie. Examples include little pasta meatball bites to reflect the spaghetti western of Django Unchained, or chocolate-covered bacon to reflect the this-makes-no-sense nature of Tree of Life. I love that idea, just the make-no-sense nature of Tree of Life. That's great. We also got a comment from Neil. He didn't sign his last name. I'm going to assume this is maybe Neil Whitney, who always comments. If not, alternate Neil, please let me know. If it is Neil Whitney, great. Thank you for leaving feedback. He says, I loved how you opened and closed the show with Jack Nicholson circa Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah, I always liked, of course, to end the show with trailers or open the show with trailers, and I couldn't think of what to do for Oscars. And then I thought, oh, that'll be perfect. Just do part one, part two of the Oscar speech. So thanks for noticing, Neil. Regarding episode 30, which was Shadow of a Doubt with our buddy Ange, Chuck Coletta says, I was so glad to hear you discuss this classic Hitchcock film that still remains something of a hidden gem to many. I always thought much of the credit for the movie's success was due to the screenplay by Thornton Wilder of Our Town fame. Here he offers another interesting take on small-town American life. Both Santa Rosa and Grover's Corner seem idyllic on the surface, but there are darker undercurrents lurking below. It was also nice to hear you spotlight actress Patricia Collins, who made only a handful of films. Her best work is in The Little Foxes, as a tragic Birdie Hubbard. I've never seen Little Foxes, so I'll have to check that out, Chuck. Thank you. And thank you for mentioning Thornton Wilder. I don't think we mentioned that at all, which was an oversight on my part, because, you know, when you have a screenplay by Thornton Wilder, you're off to a pretty good start. Chuck also sent in a really good clip. He says, this clip is too good to pass up. Here's a 1969 Hitchcock appearance on the Mike Douglas Show, where he mentions that The Shadow of a Doubt is his personal favorite. Get a load of that panel sitting with Hitchcock, Joan Rivers, Rod McEwen, and James Brown. Yeah, Mike Douglas and Dick Cavett were really good at that. They didn't have their guests leave the cast, so sometimes you ended up with really amazing guests. There was an episode, there's a Simpsons commentary where Matt Groening goes off on this, and he talks about watching an episode that had Salvador Dali and Lillian Gish. And Salvador Dali came out with an armadillo and dropped the armadillo in Lillian Gish's lap, who was not amused. So that's fun stuff. Thank you, Chuck. Chris Franklin from the network, Fire and Water Podcast Network, says, sorry to say I'm not familiar with this film. I'll have to keep an eye out for it on TCM. I'm really behind on Hitchcock films, only really knowing the ones everyone knows. Definitely adding this to the Film and Water list. Thank you, Chris. Ciscoid, also on the network, says, I saw Shadow of a Doubt for the first time last year, and the more I thought about it afterwards, the more I liked it. It really grows on you. It's a tour de force in creating a relatable villain that creeps you out as much as he does his niece, the more things come to light. Absolutely. Chuck Coletta came back again on this episode and said, one filmmaker you don't often associate with Hitchcock is Woody Allen, but some of his more recent films do bear Hitchcock's influence. Match Point, Cassandra's Dream, An Irrational Man. Even the more comedic Scoop with Hugh Jackman and Scarlett Johansson has a touch of Hitch. Maybe this is just my way of asking for a Woody-centric episode. No problem, Chuck. I absolutely want to do that. I love Woody Allen's, you know, I hate to be such a cliche, but I love his early stuff. And I would love to talk about some of his 70s output, including Annie Hall, which I think is one of the greatest films ever made. So Woody's coming at some point. Paul Hicks wrote in to say, never heard about this one, but now I definitely want to check it out. Thanks, Paul. You should do that. Michael Bridges says, I've never seen this film, but we're looking forward to see for Joseph Cotten's performance. Absolutely worth it. As I talked about on the show, I love Joseph Cotten. So, regarding episode 31, which is Starman, which I did with our pal Chris Cummins, Jose Rivera wrote in to say, just wanted to say how much I enjoyed you and Chris talking about Starman. I'm a huge Carpenter fan, and this one slipped me by. I've seen bits of it when it came to cable with my dad, but I was too young to understand it. So I'm definitely going to have to give it a watch. I got to say, I love Karen Allen, too. There's something so appealing about her and her performances. I'm of the age where The Sandlot was a big deal when I was a kid. She was one of the coolest moms I'd ever seen in film. Chris Franken wrote in to say, I'm with you on Karen Allen. Well, maybe not quite as passionately. As a huge fan of Superman, the movie, as you well know, I've often wondered how Allen would have been as Lois Lane. She and Margot Kidder were of similar type at a similar time, but, no offense to Margot, I think Allen had a deeper well of acting talent to pull from. The mind boggles. And he says, go ahead and book Chris to return in December for Scrooge. We're absolutely going to do that. I've already talked to Chris about coming back for a bunch of different episodes because I really enjoyed having him on. So, yeah. And, yeah, Karen Allen as Lois Lane. I don't know if I see that. She seems a little too soft. I think Margot Kidder had that hard edge, which was perfect for Lois Lane. But, yeah, they did have kind of a similar type. And for years, I always used to think Karen Allen was in Amityville Horror. When it's not, it's Margot Kidder. But I was like, oh, yeah, Karen Allen, she's in Amityville Horror. No, she's not. Jeff Nettleton says, I saw Starman in college at a dorm showing. We got movies circulated among the residence halls and had a movie night each week, not too long after it was in theaters. It's a nice little film, not a big Spielberg production or some deep Kubrick metaphorical piece, just good storytelling. Siskoid says, what is it with the network lately? Is it a Starman festival no one told me about? He's referring to the fact that just in the previous week, Chris Franklin and I had done an episode of the Fire and Water podcast where Chris was guesting, where we talked about first issue special number 12, which was Starman. And truth be told, that's kind of how I got the idea to do Starman for Film and Water. I was like, oh, that'd be kind of fun to do a whole Starman roadblock. And then I reached out to find somebody, and luckily Chris Cummins chimed in to do the show with me. So yeah, it was sort of accidentally intentional, if that even makes sense. Siskoid also mentions that he has to mention he's got to tell his fellow Lonely Heart Marty about this. He's as big, at least, a Carpenter fan as the two of you are. And then Marty wrote in to say, Siskoid is right. I love me some Carpenter gushing. I was smiling the whole way through. I've already talked to Marty about coming on the show to do a Carpenter film, and we're going to do that because, yeah, I could go through the whole Carpenter oeuvre, except, you know, maybe Village of the Damned. But Nathaniel Wayne says, this is a movie I haven't thought about in a long time and really should revisit. I saw it in my very early teens and enjoyed it quite a bit, but I think I only watched maybe one other time. It's one of those that I think would be good to look back at now with a more developed, a.k.a. rotted, adult mind, with years of jaded movie-going experiences weighing me down. Yep, I'm sure it'll be a good time. Great episode as usual, and hopefully before too long, Jeff Bridges will help finance the Tron-Starman crossover, where we learn that Isos from Tron Legacy was a digital extension, or were a digital extension of the Starman's alien technology. You know, that's not as far-fetched as it sounds. I mean, if we can do, if Sony's going to do a Men in Black 21 Jump Street crossover, Tron and Starman, yeah, why not? Neil comes back to say, regarding Starman, but mostly what I gathered from this episode is that this must be a backdoor pilot to Rob's new show, Kelly on Karen, a Karen Allen tribute podcast, a show I would listen to. You know, who knows? the irredeemable Shag, my partner over on Fire and Water Podcast, says, really enjoyed your coverage. I'm not so good with the words and stuff. That's true. You guys really brought out all the feelings I couldn't articulate. It was a very entertaining 45-minute Karen Allen celebration. Looking forward to the K-Al podcast. You know, enough people suggested. Regarding episode 32, which was Twilight Zone, Jose Rivera writes in, he says, finally, if you and Derek do another horror anthology, I'd love to hear you talk about Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, or 1983's Nightmares. I was kind of joking about Tales from the Dark Side because I don't remember that much from that movie or thinking it was all that great. I didn't like the show that much, but Nightmares is interesting. I've never actually seen Nightmares. I know of it, but I've never actually seen it. So that might even be worth doing just so I could go and watch it for the first time. So good suggestion, Jose. Who knows? Ryan Daly says, I've never seen this movie, but I remember hearing that after the disaster during filming, Spielberg actively tried to get John Landis banned from directing anything in Hollywood. I have no idea if that's true or not, but I think it's notable that after Landis's home run derby of Animal House, The Blues Brothers, American Werewolf in London, and Trading Places, once you get to Twilight Zone and his IMDb page, the list becomes a whole lot of music videos, documentaries, shorts, and TV episodes for the next 5 years, with the notable exceptions of Three Amigos and Coming to America, and then movies nobody cares about for the rest of the list. Maybe Landis didn't go to jail for the deaths on the set of Twilight Zone, but it forever knocked him out of the realm of greatest director. Yeah, I think I said on the show, I don't know whether that is an effect of what happened on the set or just the natural attrition of his career, because not all directors are, you know, huge for that long. And he had a really good run, and it may just been sort of a what naturally happens in some people's career, but I guess we'll never know. Chris Franken wrote in to say, it's been years since I've seen this. I think it was part of because, as Derek put it, I learned how the sausage was made. I seem to recall something about the controversy surrounding this flick from Entertainment Tonight or one of those shows. That always seemed to be on the evening on that show always seemed to be on the evenings in my house as a kid. I didn't realize how grisly it was until my adult years. That has put the film in a kind of taboo place in my mind. For some reason, I've never really transferred that over to other Landis projects, but maybe I should. I'm kind of like you, Rob. I avoid Mel Gibson films now, but it's somewhat hypocritical of me not to do the same to Landis. I have the same problem with Geoffrey Jones being in many of my favorite films. Yeah, I don't have any problem watching the films of someone who has sort of had a troubled life, and that's being kind to Geoffrey Jones. I don't have a problem watching films that took place before you learn about what happened to them, if that makes a lot of sense. Like, I love Ed Wood. That's one of my all-time favorite movies, and I have no problem watching Geoffrey Jones in it. He's great in it. He's great in Beetlejuice. He's great in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But if he was in a movie now, yeah, I think I would have some issues. I'm kind of that way also with Roman Polanski. You know, I continue to watch Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown because they're masterpieces. But when he has a new film, I really have very little interest in seeing it because I just kind of don't want to reward that guy. He also, Chris also points out, he says, great episode. I hope you and Derek do cover Tales from the Dark Side, although I've never seen that one. The opening to the TV show used to scare the bejesus out of me. Don't forget about all those great Amicus horror anthology films like Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror based on the EC Comics. Yeah, I would love to do Tales from the Crypt. I just wrote a review for that movie for my Real Retro Cinema column over on 13dimension.com, and that's a lot of fun. So yeah, that would be a really good one to do. Chuck Coletta wrote in, I am currently teaching an undergrad course on television as popular culture at BGSU, and I always include a session on Serling in the Twilight Zone. Whenever my classes watch Time Enough at Last, there is always an audible gasp when Burgess Meredith drops and breaks his glasses. It still packs a volume. Yeah, Twilight Zone holds up way better than any 50-year-old show should, so yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. He also comments, Dana Gould's most recent podcast has a section devoted to Serling. Yeah, Dana Gould, comedian David Gould, does a great show called The Dana Gould Hour, and it is a really, truly great podcast. He only does one episode a month. I guess that gives him time to really, like, edit it together, and he has different segments, and they come in and out. It's a really, really good show. Go to his site. I think it's just danagould.com, or go to iTunes and subscribe to it. It's well worth your time. It's very funny and very interesting. Jeff Nettleton writes in to say, I was in high school when the accident happened, and I remember it and the surrounding involuntary manslaughter trial well. Landis never seemed to take responsibility as the person in charge of the set for the events. That lowers him in my eyes. However, I can watch his films. I don't necessarily see it as willful as much as sad. And Robinson wrote in to say, I'm sure most everybody who listens is familiar with this, but since you brought up the mischievous gremlins from Looney Tunes, I figured I'd add this bit too. I have always read stories of WW2 pilots blaming faulty planes and problems they would have while flying on gremlins getting in the works. This spiraled into tales of how, when flying through thick cloud banks and fog, gremlins would actually get onto a plane's wing and begin tearing things apart. Always just kind of assumed this was an inspiration for the story, but I could be completely wrong. Oh, I bet you're right, Clinton. I mean, there was the gremlins in the Bugs Bunny cartoons where they're literally tearing up planes, and that was during World War II, so I think you can draw a direct line there. Mike Bridges says, I'll comment as best I can from my phone, so please excuse any typos. I saw this in a theater when I was a kid probably 5 or 6 times. I loved it as a kid. But I remember always thinking something was missing in the first installment. I always thought, is that it? Probably being 10 when this came out, I had no idea about the accident. It just seemed incomplete. Regarding the last segment, what can I say? It's awesome. And when I think of this, I always think of no smoking, as spelled out by the little girl. So much so to this day that when I see someone smoking in a non-smoking area, this line pops into my head. I love that little kid. No smoking. Siskoid asks, are you going to force Derek to review Cat's Eye or VHS or just skip to Trick or Treat? How long will the horror anthology hell last? Clint Robinson then came back with saying, I'm waiting for the comedy anthology hell. Start with History of the World Part 1, move on to Amazon Women on the Moon, and end with Kentucky Fried Movie. I love Amazon Women on the Moon. I might have to do that. I think that's a really funny movie. It's very hit or miss, as all anthologies are, but there are parts of Amazon Women on the Moon just make me laugh so really hard. So that might be worth doing, just for the Son of the Invisible Man segment with Ed Begley Jr. Episode 33 was Cloverfield. Chris Franklin says, I'll admit, I haven't seen Cloverfield, mostly because, like you guys, I was already burnt out on found footage movies by that point. I hate to admit this, but I'm not a big fan of giant monster films. Sorry, just not really my cup of tea. Having said all that, this episode makes me reconsider. I need to check it out now. Well done, gentlemen. Nathaniel Wayne says, I haven't even listened to the episode yet, so I may come back with additional thoughts, but I wanted to put this on record. To date, this is the only film that has made me physically ill. I don't like it when my brain can't predict what the camera is going to do. It's the same reason I get nauseous watching other people play first-person video games. So found footage can make me a bit queasy. This was the first and so far only time it actually made me violently ill, as I had to actually leave the theater to throw up in a trash can I could find. Whoa! I think even at the time they had little signs up in theaters about Cloverfield saying if you have that problem, you shouldn't see this film. I seem to remember something like that. Later, Nathaniel came back. Oh, okay, now having listened, I have some additional thoughts. Matt Reeves is a skilled director, but in many ways, he didn't come into his own for me until Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is phenomenal. Yeah, I did like his other movies, as I mentioned, but yeah, I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is really a step up. And he's doing the next Apes film, which I'm happy about, but at the same time, I wouldn't mind if he was freed up to do other things. I think he would be, and I think I said this on the episode, a terrific dark Star Wars episode director. I think he's one of those guys who can sort of subsume his natural style into whatever story needs to be told. And I think he would be, and we know he can do sort of sci-fi and genre stuff. So yeah, I think Matt Reeves would be a terrific Star Wars director. But that said, I am looking forward to the next Apes film. Siskoid recommends, in terms of horror films, Pontypool, which is a fine example. A weird zombie apocalypse of a sort happens outside, but we're trapped in a radio station experiencing mostly through sound. I love that stuff. Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about Pontypool. I will have to try and search that out. David Ace Gutierrez says, I look forward to the animated series starring Clovey and Clovezuki. And Clovezuki. Jose Rivera says, I'll put this more in a message through the website, but I didn't like Cloverfield. For me, at least, it was a case of the mystery and the marketing being much stronger than the film itself. You had to go to other avenues to get answers, and I found it very hard to identify with the characters. Yeah, that can happen with J.J. Abrams movies. I think that happened with Into Darkness. He was so concerned about keeping it a mystery that they forgot to make like a kind of a decent movie. So yeah, sometimes Abrams can get a little ahead of himself. I have to say, his whole thing about when he was talking about 10 Cloverfield Lane as a blood relative, that stuff just annoyed me. I was like, come on, it's the same. Just say it's the same universe. Everybody understands what that means. Don't be so cutesy. Regarding episode 34, which is the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Siskoid says, love Andy's enthusiasm as usual. And yeah, the actors and all that. Obviously, I'm interested in the Doctor Who connection, but I'm all about Harryhausen stuff in these films. Jason and the Argonauts and all that shine even when the film drags its feet. Love looking at these things and remain a fan of stop motion today. I just saw Laika's new trailer, and Kubo and the Two Strings looks awesome. I second Rob's recommendation on the original King Kong commentary track, and watch it, the movie without it too. It's so great. I can't believe it was made when it was made or how it was made. Spoiler for Andy, there are only good three Apes movies, the original and the two recent ones. I would argue with that, Siskoid. I love the other Apes movies, even though I can't argue that they're particularly very good, but I really enjoy them, especially Escape from Planet of the Apes. Chris Franklin says, you had me at Caroline Monroe. As a Hammer guy, I am aware of her charms. For a part she really shines in, check out Captain Crono's Vampire Hunter. I recently rewatched this one, and she's great in it, and of course, she looks great. I know Hammer had another actress in mind for the Vampirella film that was in pre-production but sadly never got made, but Monroe was born to play it. Not sure if the dates died for her to influence Talia. I saw that 13th Dimension piece as well, but she would have been perfect as Batman's beloved. Yeah, oh, Caroline Monroe as Vampirella is more than my feeble brain can imagine. That's unbelievable. Jeff Nettleton says, Harryhausen is a great adventure, and I still remember being scared to death when Kerman Matthews fights the skeleton in Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. I watched all the Harryhausen Sinbads, and this one is my favorite. Nathaniel Wayne says, fun listen as usual. I realized how limited my own experience is with Sinbad and films. I've only seen one Sinbad film, the 1947 one with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. And while I do enjoy it in my youth, I'm coming to realize, though, that what I hear and see elsewhere, that it's easily the least fantastical Sinbad story to ever be put to film. Not a single fantasy creature in sight. Still a solid swashbuckler. Jeff Nettleton. This is the perfect template for an adventure film. You have a capable hero with a bit of a reputation, a truly evil and powerful villain to offset the hero, a ticking clock, a beautiful mysterious woman, some comic relief, monsters, exotic locales, danger, and vibrant battles. It spills over with imagination. That's a good way of putting it. It really does. He says, Caroline Monroe is a tremendous beauty and a decent actress, though she's done more than her share of bad films, Star Crash, for example. She's also the sexy journalist with the glasses in Adam Ant's Goody Two Shoes video, a favorite of mine from the early days of MTV. I completely forgot that. I used to love that video, probably for that reason. Plus, the song is catchy. Guys do make passes at girls who wear glasses, especially when they look like Caroline Monroe. Yeah, I have to go back and find that video. I just forgot that that's who it was. Yeah, oh, God, she's Caroline Monroe. It's just unbelievable. Comp Shag says, another great show. Always fun to hear Andy on an episode. I've never actually seen this movie. In fact, I've only seen a couple of Ray Harryhausen films, Clash of the Titans, obviously. However, you make it sound so tremendously fun, I want to run right out and see it. Might have to watch it with the kids. I like the description of adventure movie with a capital A. Great sales pitch. I'd forgotten that this was Tom Baker's breakthrough performance. Now I really need to see it. And just Google Caroline Monroe. Well, you know what I'd say. Keep up the great work. Jeff Nelton responded with, she's not hot, Shag. She's volcanic. And he also mentioned, by the by, Rob, how can someone named Kelly not do an episode about The Quiet Man for St. Patrick's Day? And then Neil chimes in with, oh, by the way, Maureen O'Hara is hot. I'm not, I don't know, take this however you want to take it. I'm just not all that big on, like, my Irish heritage, just not something that interests me. So St. Patrick's Day just kind of comes and goes for me. Ange says, regarding Golden Voyage of Sinbad, great episode. I'm a huge Harryhausen guy. One thing you know about his gladiator mythology flicks, there will always be a gorgeous woman. Caroline Monroe is at the top of that list. Insanity. Neil chimes in, yet another backdoor pilot to add a podcast to the FNW net. The Caroline Monroe fan cast. Hopefully there will be a page on the website full of pictures of the parts of the movie you guys would be talking about. Yeah, we might have to flag the site at that point. Probably get banned on a couple different networks. But nobody's going to get tired of looking at pictures of Caroline Monroe. David Ace Gutierrez refers to the Golden Voyage of Sinbad as the Caroline Monroe movie starring Tom Baker. He also sends in a link to a Caroline Monroe action figure that someone has made. I'll leave that all to your imaginations. You can click the link on the Fire and Water Facebook page. Zeb Oswald says, cool podcast. Never saw this one. I did see the Lou Ferrigno Sinbad. There's one where some woman turns into a bird. Someone shoots the bird with an arrow. She escapes, but the bird has webbed feet through the rest of the movie. I've never seen the Lou Ferrigno Sinbad. I've seen the Lou Ferrigno Hercules where he throws a bear into outer space. That might be worth covering. Van Z says, damn it, Rob Kelly. This is the third time. The third time this podcast made me go to Amazon and order a DVD. You are costing me money. It's called Payola, Van. By the way, I should mention, Van hosts the All-Star Comics podcast. That's a really fun show. You should all listen to that. And then finally, our pal Ryan Daly, host of Give Me Those Star Wars over on the Fire and Water Podcast Network and the Secret Origins podcast, says, Rob Kelly and Andy Kapelish discuss a movie about the guy from a different world. I never knew Sinbad played a pirate, but looking at his comedy in the 90s, I can totally see it. You know, I really wanted to mention Ryan because he was kind enough to write in, but I really shouldn't have because this me mentioning him on the show is only going to encourage this kind of behavior, and I don't want to do that. So that is going to do it for listener feedback. If I left anybody out, I am very much sorry. I really appreciate all the retweets and all the action we have on the Twitter page, which is Film and Water Pod, and all the other comments we get. I really, really appreciate it. The show is getting sort of more and more popular as the episodes roll on, and that is very rewarding to me. So thanks, everybody, for writing in, and please keep doing so. Again, please leave iTunes reviews, and you can always leave direct messages over on the network page, the contact page at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So I guess that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Thanks so much to Chris Franklin for coming back and talking about Hollywoodland. As I mentioned, we are going to be covering Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice over on the Fire and Water podcast, not this show. So when you're looking for the review of that movie, make sure to go over to Fire and Water Podcast if you don't subscribe to the all-in-one feed, which you should be doing anyway. So, again, thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.